Hello, everybody. Welcome to History Chat Live, Tea Time History Chat Live. It is Wednesday, the 13th of March, and we're going to be talking today about some of the places outside of London to do with Roman Britain, which I would thoroughly recommend that you visit if you possibly can. And I'm going to show you why. I'm just going to talk about them, actually. So even if you can't get to them, I'm going to do my best to tell the story of them. Last week, I covered places to see of Roman Britain in London specifically. So we're going to get out of London today and have a look at some others. So welcome. Thank you for joining me. And so I'm going to talk about Roman Britain. I'm going to cover a variety of different places. So we're going to have a look at a legionary fortress, fort, one of the largest Roman cities, what's remaining of it, a palace, a temple, and a luxury Roman villa. So that's where we're going to go to today. It is by no means an exhaustive list of Roman sites in Britain. But feel free in the comments to put other ones. And if you enjoy today, maybe I can do a follow-on episode about some of the others. So for instance, today I'm not covering Hadrian's Wall, which is of course incredibly famous, 80 mile long wall at the most northern frontier of what was Britannia. Actually the inspiration for the wall in George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones, which was the first book of his Song of Fire and Ice series. And of course it was made into an HBO series, which I only got into a couple of years ago and absolutely loved it. So Becky, no, I'm not doing Halstead's or Vindolanda. What I could do, if you want me to, if people are interested enough, is I can do an entire one on Hadrian's Wall, perhaps. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe I'll do that one on site as well, because I fancy going back up there. We can do that. But let me tell you about some places today that maybe you won't know of. And I think you'll find equally as fascinating. There's also places like Porchester. I'm not covering that today. That's a Roman Saxon shore fort, one of the best preserved north of the Alps. Excuse me. It's also in its walls has a 12th century castle, which was built. And then after the Romans left in the Anglo-Saxon period, it was occupied as well. There's evidence that it was occupied, but we're not going to cover there either. I could have done Chester with its Roman walls and its remaining amphitheatre. Chester's incredible. Again, maybe I'll do one from Chester at some point. It's actually a medieval town within a Roman wall. Still looks very medieval. There's also Cirencester, St Albans, Gloucester. Now, if you listen to those names, you'll hear a link in the names of all those places. Chester is a city in its own right, but you'll hear Chester on the end of others. Other names, and that means a camp of soldiers. It's a suffix to place names, and it comes in the form of Chester, Caster, and Cester. So, for example, Manchester, Lancaster, Gloucester. When you realise that, you can see just how many Roman settlements there were around Britain that you can still hear in this place names today. So, Becky, I was actually in Chester on the weekend for family reasons. I'm likely to be in Chester quite often going forward. So I'm geeking out on that, definitely. So, right. Well, I'm streaming live on YouTube, Facebook and Instagram. A warm welcome to you for joining me live. And also if you're watching on the catch up or you're listening on the podcast, thank you, everyone, for your support. You can go one step further and support me with badges on Instagram, stars on Facebook, and super chats on YouTube. If you do buy a super chat on YouTube, then you are guaranteed for me to read out your comment or question. But the way I would love you to support me, because I can give you so much more back, and many of you have already done this, is to find me in Patreon, patreon.com/British History. And all members automatically get an incredible array now, I think, of benefits, including being part of the book club. We had our latest book club meeting on Sunday. We were discussing Gareth Russell's book, The Palace. It was a fabulous discussion. It is now, the recording of that is now posted into Patreon. So anyone who couldn't make the meeting, you can go in there and watch it and put your comments below and maybe and carry on the discussion. Our next book, if you're interested in book club, is the red one behind me on the shelf. I can't get my pointing backwards correctly. There you go. It is Nicola Tallis's biography of Margaret Beaufort. That will be our next, book in book club, and the one we will be meeting next. And I must give a shout out to Jennifer, Layla and Marcy, who all joined in the past week. Also must mention, if you're a patron, you don't just get early access to event and tour tickets, but you actually get discounts on event tickets. And the next event, I must make mention of this, is the Stuarts Online History Festival. It is the weekend after next, so it's the 22nd till the 24th of March. And if you're a patron, you get your tickets for, I think it's £18 rather than £21.50, so it's a £3.50 discount, which equates to 16%. Randomly. It sounds random if I say 16%, but it is 16%. Behind me, let me just tell you the speaker lineup. Gareth Russell is going to be talking about Anna of Denmark. Fascinating woman. Hilarious. Oh my God. Just wait till you hear what she got up to. Alice Hunt is talking about Oliver Cromwell and the English Republic. That was a topic that a lot of people asked for. Andrea Zuvich is talking about royal mistresses and that tenuous power of beauty at the Stuart court. Julian Humphreys is talking about the escape of Charles II after the Battle of Worcester, a hunted king, he's titled it. And it was a epic, it is an epic tale of escape, of near capture, of having to walk in somewhere with the confidence of someone who doesn't think they're going to be found. It's a lot of hiding in plain sight involved. Incredible story. Katie Wignall is talking about the Great Fire of London and tracking that story around the City of London. Katie is a brilliant Blue Badge guide with a number of books out about London. And I myself are doing a talk this time. I'm talking about the gunpowder plot, but what I'm talking about specifically is the build-up to the gunpowder plot and what drove the conspirators to plan such a heinous act. So that is the Stuarts Online History Festival. You can get tickets for that at thestuarts2024.eventbrite.co.uk. And like I say, if you're a patron, you get 16% discount, very specific, and you can access that by going into Patreon and clicking the link. Also behind me, I must mention, other than the book that's now in book club, that we're doing in book club, Nicola Tallis's Fateful Life of Margaret Beaufort, the book next to it, some of you might recognize, that is Nathan Armin's book on the Tudor pretenders. The reason it's behind me is because I interviewed Nathan this morning. Oh my God, we had such a good time. It was brilliant. Now that interview, thank you to all my patrons who put forward their questions for Nathan. That obviously is another benefit of being a member of Patreon, but also you will get early access to that interview. It's going to come out on Sunday for patrons with the extended version. Obviously it's ad free. And then for everyone else, it will be out a week on Sunday. And in the next few weeks, I'm going to be interviewing Sharon Bennett Connolly on the women of the anarchy, Estelle Peronc about her new book about Anne Boleyn's time in France, and Gareth Benjamin Streeter about Arthur Tudor. So if any of those grab your fancy and you would like to put any questions to any of those historians, then please do come over to patreon.com/British History. And if you're not already a member, you can check out all the benefits, but it's £5 a month and you get access to the entire back catalogue as well as all the benefits going forward. Now, so that is that. Becky says, can't wait to meet and hear from him in September. Yes, Nathan is speaking on the Rise of the Tudors tour, which is now fully booked, I think, as of yesterday. That's going to be very, very exciting. And I saw, Becky, that you said you're going to Chester after the September tour. You'll love it. In fact, I might be going to Chester after the tour, but anyway, we'll chat. A woman, hello, welcome, living in Exeter. You have a Roman wall, yes, of course, which is visible everywhere. Brilliant, I love it. Well, I mean, they built stuff to last. It's incredible, doesn't it? Melissa is asking when the book club is. The book club, off the top of my head, is 17th of May. No, it can't be the 17th of May. I'm on tour that day. It's in Patreon. There is a post with all of the dates on it, but I will remind everybody near the time anyway, or I'll post that soon. So let's talk about Roman Britain. So we talked about Roman London last week and some of the places that you can go and see still evidence of the Romans in Londinium. May 12th, thank you, Becky. Oh, before tour, yeah. Tour, yes, that's right. It's in between the two tours. Thank you, Becky. I knew what I was thinking, but I'm back. I'm going. Yeah, that's it. It's right in the middle. And there was a few places that I hope were a little bit of a surprise to people. Even if not, it's good to be reminded of places that you can go in London. Now, these as well, three of them were underground, and so you can't see them from the top, and it's from street level, so it's quite good to know that they're there. But when the Romans occupied Britain, this was their most northern and western point. They found it. And they occupied Britain or Britannia for over 350 years. They first came in AD 43 under the Emperor Claudius. There's a little bit of faffing before that with Caesar. But once they came and settled, the impact on our landscape changed forever. They built forts, cities, roads. Roads are probably the most enduring physical influence in this country. We still follow many of the old Roman roads or our main roads. Some of them have turned into motorways. Some of them have actually become little lanes. It's very interesting. Villas they built, which is an interesting concept for this climate, I have to say. It encouraged more outdoor living, which actually I think would be nice, but we didn't follow on with that. Temples, bathhouses, they built all these sorts of things, and you could expect a certain layout of their buildings and of their cities or towns, elements that would be there. Bathhouses and temples, of course, pop up all over the place. Forum, so the civic buildings, of course, the Romans brought with them civil organization, civic, this is where we get the word civilization from. And it's fascinating to visit both private buildings and public buildings, and I have a mix of those for you today. Rome's strategy of conquest is, I mean, I haven't studied all the other ones, but I think it's fairly unique in that they had this strategy of integrating the lands that they conquered. And once they did conquer, however they did conquer, and of course it wasn't always peaceful at all, but that area would then gain peace and protection from Rome. It would also gain trade links to Rome. And those who could afford it would find that their lifestyle might increase in luxury, in access to, think of obvious ones, wine, olive oil. They would bring crafts, so obviously they see the mosaics start. And in response, in return, should I say, there was an obligation to provide manpower to the empire. And so men in the legions might find themselves posted all over the place. So people in Britain, the Romans that came to Britain weren't necessarily Roman at all, in fact. There's evidence of people from Spain, people from Africa, all over the Roman Empire being in Britain. But it was a very successful system, that citizenship. So they take over, but then you become Roman. You're sort of taken into the fold and you get the benefits. And almost the Romans didn't understand why anyone wouldn't want that. And they did, of course, hit on a number of places that weren't interested, Scotland being one, who weren't interested in what they, in the Romans, saw as benefits of being part of the Roman Empire. But anyway, like I say, I could probably cover Hadrian's Wall on its own. But usually once integration began, military presence from external soldiers would be withdrawn or at least reduced. But that wasn't the case in Britain, in Britannia. The forts remained occupied and functional during the entire occupation, should I say. And once the Romans withdrew, the Roman influence literally declined as well. It went with them, or so we thought, but in Maine it does. But there's a bit of evidence that I'm going to come to of some continuation. But like I say, we're not doing the most obvious places today. So I'm not going to do Hadrian's Wall, but I am going to take you to one of the forts which was already existing when Hadrian's Wall was built. I think Hadrian's Wall was built 200 and something AD. Soldiers from the three established forts, these are permanent barracks. There's three of them in Britain. Now, Caerleon is where we're going to go, but there was also Chester and York. But anyway, so we're going to go to Caerleon today. Caerleon. Oh, when I interviewed Nathan this morning, Nathan is from Wales, and I said, please help me with the pronunciation of this because I know I'm getting it wrong. Right, I'm going to show you. You might have seen on my thumbnail for today this incredible amphitheatre. So for those of you listening on the podcast, on YouTube, if you get a chance to go and have a look, I've put up some pictures of the places I'm talking about today. And Caerleon, which should have a rolling R in the middle, but that's maybe a step too far for me, is near Cardiff, so South Wales, closer to, I suppose, to the English border. It's actually, Caerleon is Welsh for legion fortress. So it had a permanent legion based here, which only two other places did. During the Roman time, it was called Isca. Okay, I'm assuming that's how it's pronounced, I-S-C-A. And it has this incredible amphitheatre. There is a swimming pool, which the remains of which have been discovered, and a barracks. And all of those are so well preserved that you can get a real feel of what it was like there, and you can walk between the sites, so you also get a feel of how everything was set up and set out. also, if you ever get to Caerleon, and if I do a Roman tour, I'm going to fit Caerleon in, because it really is incredible. I'm going to speak more about this amphitheatre in a moment, because it's got an amazing feel for it, but I'll tell you why in a minute. But there's also the National Roman Legion Museum, which is run by the National Museum of Wales there, and they have thousands of artifacts on display that they found in the Isca area. And it has so much insight into what it was like to be a Roman soldier. Melissa just said swimming pool. Yes. Let me show you. I'll just skip on. So they've built a building around the swimming pool. This swimming pool, if I remember right, it would have been the outdoor part of the bathhouse. Roman cities, they have bathhouses. Romans were very, they were keen on cleanliness, but they were keen on looking after your body. They were keen on exercise. They were keen on looking after your skin. And they did this in these bath complexes. You would exercise, and you would then, we're going to see a couple of examples of this. You would look after your skin by way of, it sounds brilliant. You'd put this oil on your skin, and then you go into a series of ever-increasing heated rooms. So you'd actually start at it's called a frigidarium. Yeah, frigidarium, which is a cold room, which you'd get you undressed and you warm your oil on, into a tepidarium, warmer room. And you'd be in a coldarium. I think I've got that right, where I imagine it's a bit like a sauna. It was a very, very hot room, and you could pour water and onto hot rocks or whatever and make the steam. So you'd sweat it all out, you pause, and then you'd be scraped down, depending on where you were, either by a friend or a slave, or maybe somebody of lower rank than you. And then you would cool off they'd have things like, I mean, cold plunges have come back in now, very fashionable to cold plunge, and they would have a cold plunge and that would cleanse you. So they are, these are not just for leisure, their bathhouses. They took, and I think this is something that there's a few things I think we could take from the Romans, and their emphasis on physical and, by virtue of that, mental health was really, really, I think if we instigated it again, we would enjoy ourselves a bit more. So anyway, you've got that. Melissa says very Greek concepts. Well, yes, of course. Yeah, Greek, Roman. Absolutely. The Romans took a lot from the Greeks. A woman says this is your handle, a woman. 1970s, a huge bathhouse was excavated next to Exeter Cathedral, but it was filled in again. And the cathedral cannot afford to re-excavate it. Yes. That's, of course, what they do with many things now. There's a Roman, going off topic a little bit now, but in Worcester, there's a Roman gate near Worcester Cathedral. And it was excavated when they were putting in a new cathedral square a few years ago. And that has been covered up again. So they sort of excavate, take as many records and everything as they can, and then rebury it to preserve, the best way to preserve it. So yeah, so there's this bath, and if anyone watching, you can see that they have created a light show, a bit like some of the places in London have, and you can actually see someone swimming up and down in the pool. But it's just lights. Quite fun. I'm going to come back to the amphitheatre, but before I do, this is the remains of the barracks. And you can see the foundations of row upon row upon row of these, well, literally barracks. So there were small rooms, a number of men to each room. There was a communal house of easement, to put it politely, in one corner. You can also see, yes, what we're looking at on the slide that I've put up, on the picture I've put up, is the entranceway. So this would have been a guarded entranceway with a tower. The wall, where I've taken this photograph from, I'm stood on what would have been the perimeter wall of the barracks. That would, of course, gone all the way around. And in the far corner of the barracks, where we're looking at that photograph, is where the House of Easement was. So, Becky, they do that in Scandinavia. Yeah, go from sauna to cold water. Yeah, outside in the winter. Yeah, it's incredibly good for you, apparently. We're all a bit, gone a bit nesh. And we should harden ourselves up by doing this thing. But apparently it's amazing for your skin. So there you go. So back to the amphitheatre. I shared some more of this amphitheatre in Patreon. Sorry, I've got a helmet. When I went last summer, you can walk through a number. I think there's two of the main entrances. So on complete opposite, on direct opposite sides of each other, the entrances where the carts would have come in, the animals would have come in, and you can still walk through there. You can also walk down some of the steps, so where spectators would have gone. There's some steps up into the stands. Some of those still survive. There's an archway that still survives. That like I say, then there's these steps actually through this archway that lead up to some of the where the seating would be. There's also evidence of a temple there, a small temple to, and I think it's the goddess Diana. I might have that wrong, but sorry, I can't remember off the top of my head. I've just thought of that again. This is a little temple which the competitors might have visited before they did whatever they did. But it's large. It's quite a large place. And when you go there now, it's really sweet. Some of the local children use it to play football in because it's actually a great size for that. It's a great size for that. So that is Caerleon, got it right now. It's run by Cadbury, which is the Welsh equivalent to English Heritage. So definitely have a look and go there if you can. Like I say, I'm going to be taking people there on tour, I have decided. The next place is Roxeter Roman City. And what's incredible, there's a few things actually incredible about Roxeter, but that really hits you when you find out about it, is that Roxeter was absolutely gigantic. It was the fourth largest city in Roman Britain. And now you will feel like you're in the middle of the countryside. You are surrounded, it's in Shropshire. Along the Welsh border, but on the English side. You're surrounded by farmland. You're on the top of a hill. This is where they excavated the remains of this city, some of the remains of the city, because once you look, anyway, they sprawl. It would have sprawled out a much, much further distance than what you can see now. The slide I have up at the moment is a reconstruction of a Roman villa. And this was done for a TV show, I can't remember which one, where they rebuilt the villa, recreated it with Roman, as close, I think, to the ways that it would have been done. So tools, materials, craftsmanship. It's actually stood where the civic buildings would have once stood. So you can see the evidence of of pillars, which would have been the frontage to the forum. So there would have been a colonnade there. But yeah, so they've sited that villa there to show the reconstruction, although that isn't where it would have been. Melissa, is there a courtyard behind? Yes, there is. So the villa, in the villa, there is, again, this is why it's quite amusing, really, with the British climate, that the Roman villas built here still, well, this one, so being a typical one, did encourage sort of outside living, because there is a walkway at the back covered. So all the rooms, though, lead onto this outdoor corridor. There isn't an indoor corridor. So you'd have had to come out of one room and into the outside to go to another room, mainly, which I found quite amusing. So there is here at Wroxeter, I don't know if this is a bit of a weird brag, but it is the tallest surviving section of Roman wall anywhere in Britain. It's 7 foot high. Becky asks, was the climate a lot different then? I don't know. I know if you read history books and they mention the climate in passing, you will know already that sometimes it's been a lot warmer than it is now. Sometimes it's been a lot colder. Sometimes it's been a lot wetter. Sometimes it's been a lot drier. And certainly at Hadrian's Wall, which we're not actually talking about today, but at Hadrian's Wall, you've got the granaries, and they have the typical what was used in order to heat floors. So you've got columns underneath the floor with gaps for the air, and in a bathhouse that would be to warm the like underfloor heating, basically. You have that in the granaries at Hadrian's Wall because a normal barn was too damp to store the grain. So it probably was different, but I don't know how different. I don't think Britain has ever been known for it being Mediterranean style. We've known for it being a bit rainy and damp. And then sometimes, like for instance, in William Marshall's time in the 1200s, we were growing vines in the middle of Britain. So I don't know. We can't do that at the moment. Not successfully anyway. So Wroxeter has this 7 foot wall. Now that is actually a wall that went from, it's within the city's public baths again. And where you can see that hole in that wall were massive heavy wooden doors. To the back of that wall, as we're looking at it, was a huge exercise hall. And this side is where there was a bath complex. Of course, every good city has one. You can see evidence of the underfloor heating. Now there's stacks of like thin bricks, which would have been stacked. And like I say, then the floor goes on top, and there is and hot air is pumped in underneath, which heats the floor. The stacks that are at Wroxeter are replacements, because in Britain during Victorian era, tourism and interest in heritage took off massively, became very popular. We had the introduction of the weekend, days off, trains, so people could actually go to places. Trams, people could get, so anyway, travel and interest in these places grew massively, but there was little, or there seems to have been little checks on people's behavior, and souvenir hunting was massive. So these stacks of ceramic tiles at Wroxeter, which indicate where the stacks would have been, they are replacements because Victorian souvenir hunters nabbed most of them. What they went and did with them, I don't know. I understand that the Boscobel oak, which Charles II hid in during his escape after the Battle of Worcester, which of course is one of the talks at this month's Stuart Online History Festival, but the Boscobel oak actually, I'm led to believe, died because of souvenir hunters. And I think the Hatfield oak might have been the same, where Elizabeth I may or may not actually have heard that she was queen. Watch my interview with Nicola Tallis to learn more about that. Anyway, getting off track a bit, but yeah. So this big bath complex. Marianne, is there any kind of hot spring nearby? No. So in order to heat the water somewhere like Wroxeter, or heat the steam or the air that was going to pass underneath the floors, it was a matter of when you walk around the site, it's great because you can see, you can literally stand where they would have actually created the fires, and those fires would have constantly need to be stoked. So there was the series of rooms at this bathhouse, you know, from your cold to your hot. There was an outdoor swimming pool, although apparently that didn't last very long. Well, maybe the climate did have something to do with it. And this is just another picture looking out over that part of that bath complex over to where the forum would be and that reconstructed villa. In the middle there, you can't see it too clearly, but is the remains of like a mini shopping complex where there were individual shops with open windows to an inner courtyard, which the kids, when I took them when they were little, thought was fantastic, and they pretended they were shopkeepers. So Wroxeter, if you go, I have not been blessed with good weather when I've gone there. It is on the top of a hill. It is very blustery. Take a coat, even if it's just to keep you safe from the wind. Okay. Oh, my goodness. Right. This place, I'm taking to you next, Chedworth Roman Villa, was a new find for me last year. And I have to say the journey down to it, I thought I'd taken a wrong turning because it was so far down a track, and maybe it's not as bad as I remember it, but I remember it being thinking I'd made a wrong turning. But then you come across this this incredible villa. I'll tell you about it now. This Chedworth Roman Villa dates back to the 2nd century, and it had three buildings, each had few rooms in them initially, and then it was extended and improved and became a really luxury residence. There's a few theories as to who might have lived there, but it had its own bathhouse. In fact, it had two bathhouses, like a main one, which was sort of part of a entertaining complex with a dining room, and then these series of bath rooms. And it could have been that one was for the males, one was for the for females. I don't know. A lot of them mosaic, mosaics from that dining room and bathhouse still survive. So you can see a couple on the screen at the moment, and I've taken this picture from a little bit further back because you can see then that this is again a series of rooms for different purposes. What did I put in next? Oh, another one of the mosaics. Which after I've shown you a few of these places, you're like, more mosaics. Yep, seen a mosaic before. Now, with the villas, with these sort of luxury style villas, you find more of a concentration of them in the south, But Chedworth Roman Villa is near, or it's nearest to, it's in the sort of Gloucester, Cirencester area, which were major Roman settlements. And actually, there is a concentration of villas found around this one, and 14 others in a 10-mile radius around this one. So we're in the sort of Cotswold area, if that makes it a bit easier to think of where I'm talking about. And it's likely that the villa owner got their wealth by farming the land. So we are quite remote when you go now. You are in the middle of farmland. But they haven't found any evidence of agricultural buildings here, but that's not to say they didn't exist. These buildings were built of stone. And like we know with the Anglo-Saxon period, if you have wooden buildings, they're less likely to survive. It's like I say, it's not known who lived at Chedworth, but they clearly had a bit of money and a bit of status. Maybe they were part of the council that administered from Corinium, which is modern day Cirencester. See that Cester again. They may not have been Roman and have just living in a Romanized way. We just don't know. So in the west, have I put a photo of this on? There's a west wing and a north wing, the main ones. And in the west wing, there is this dining room, which I've put a picture of the floor to it on the screen now. And it does have very Greco-Roman, back to an earlier point, Greco-Roman depictions of Greco-Roman mythology depictions. So not Celtic, which could have been the other influence. It seems to try and boast a educational level, sort of I'm classically educated. And this is what I know. And it was, Chedworth was rediscovered by chance in 1864. And it was actually excavated in, I don't think I've put a picture of outside. I do apologise, of the site. It's quite difficult actually, because it's on multiple layers to get a picture of the whole site. But it was excavated within one summer in 1864. And then some of it covered back up again. And the Victorians built a museum. So there's actually a Victorian house in the middle of the site to house the museum, which is sort of interesting and quite cute. It's a bit awkward to take the photos of the site as a Roman site when there's this big lodge house in the middle of it. And it was bought up and given to the National Trust in 1924. I have found a bit more information about the mosaic. So in that dining room, you have, and any of you know who your Greek or Roman mythology will enjoy this bit, I think, particularly. You have depictions of Bacchus, the god of wine. There seems to be, I haven't got this written down, but from memory, there is depictions of both fertility symbols and signs of, what am I trying to say? Because if you think about them being farmers, they're looking very much for the abundance from the land. There's a four seasons mosaic, and I can't remember exactly where this is, but it depicts this in four corners of a mosaic. Might be in this one. It's got the four seasons. The weather's incredibly important. So you've got Cupid in winter, spring, summer, and then the autumn one is damaged. We can't see it. And there's one mosaic, and I couldn't work out from the information actually whether it's that Cupid mosaic, but it was commissioned. So there's a mosaic here at Chedworth, commissioned in the 5th century. So after the Romans had departed, which was a more phased approach than I think we're led to believe. But it also shows that people were still, in some parts, trying to maintain or were maintaining a particular lifestyle and the crafts associated with that. Let me see. Melissa says, sorry, off topic, but anyone, if anyone's interested in the castle of Scone, where the stone of Scone is, there's a channel, American Viscountess. She did the, oh, right. Okay. There you go. Yeah. Thank goodness they didn't make off with the mosaics. There's actually an incredible number of mosaics still existing. And I'm going to take you somewhere else now, which is famed for its mosaics and is even grander than the Chedworth Villa. Any of you have heard of Fishbourne Palace? There's a model of it on the screen for anyone who's listening. This is actually the like the tactile model when you go, so you can see what it looked like and you can put it apart and kids can have a play and whatever. There is a proper, if you like, model made up, but it's behind glass, so it was much more difficult to take a picture of. But it was vast. And Fishbourne Roman Palace is near Chichester in West Sussex on the south coast of England. It's one of the largest Roman palaces north of the Alps. So that immediately tells you that this was an important place for an important person. It was built around 70 AD. It was used for about 200 years. And then there was a catastrophic fire and it was abandoned after that. It was then it was discovered again until the 1960s when a trench was being built for a new water main. And the digger dug in to what we thought was just going to be a field and hit something hard. And then from that, they knew there were Roman remains in the area. Obviously, you know, other building works had pulled up little bits and bobs all over the place. But they dug some trial trenches and discovered that they'd actually found something really quite significant. Melissa asks, what's it like to see these things in situ instead of a museum? When you go to any of these places, it's, so you obviously see the buildings in situ, the mosaics in situ. That is thrilling. It is absolutely thrilling. I've just thought of one place in, sorry, you've just reminded me, there was another place in Chedworth that I wanted to just mention, actually, because I found this particularly thrilling. There was a water temple, a shrine, in the top, so it's northwest corner of the site of Chedworth Villa. And I've read two accounts of where the water comes from. So remember, this villa seems like it's in the middle of nowhere. It has two bathhouses. That's a lot of water. There was a natural spring nearby. But also maybe as well as there was water piped in from, I think it's called, a place called Woodchester, another Chester, about 20 miles away. The Romans were to be admired for their hydraulic knowledge, I think, being from a water background. I geek out on this stuff. But the water supply to the entire site would come in this northwest corner and go through the water shrine. Which now, if you're watching, you can see on screen there's a pond, but that entire area was this temple, this water shrine, and I found that really thrilling. You see a lot of the walls in situ, and like I said, and the mosaics, like you say, which is all amazing. What I find really thrilling is, even more so are things like tombstones and places. You tend to have to go to somewhere like Rome on the Appian Way to see them. I don't think we have anything like that I can think of from the top of my head. So back to Fishbourne Roman Palace. So this is the model. And then as at Chedworth, which had a special building built over the top of the mosaics to keep them, so has happened as well at Fishbourne Palace. I took this photo just to show you the vastness of the area that they uncovered. There's lots of different rooms, and you can see evidence of in some of them of how the building changed function. So it probably built for one person but with their role. So like an ambassador's house. Think of a Hampton Court palace of Wolsey. Think of a Roman equivalent for that. You're near the sea. You're taking in visitors. You're taking ambassadors. You might actually have the emperor come over. You might have the governor of Britannia over for tea, whatever. So it's vast, and this. JCB driver, this digger driver, just hit something hard and thank goodness didn't just plow into it. The mosaic that he hit, you actually can see in this building. It's covered up, and you can see the where that mosaic was damaged by the digger, but luckily not much of it. If you go to Fishbourne again, it's a place that that I would thoroughly recommend. You can see a video as well there about the whole sort of construction, how they think it happened. But it is absolutely huge. The entire site hasn't been excavated because actually there was already buildings on part of it, on quite a bit of it actually, but they have recreated as much as they can the courtyard so that you can see, at least get a feel for the size. That's one thing actually, Melissa, about being in the places, is you can get a feel for some places are smaller, some places are larger. This particular mosaic is probably one of the most famous, and I don't know if you can tell from the picture, but it almost looks black and white with a bit of faded color. And if you do see, you can see that there is reds there, yellows, blues. I imagine that would have been incredibly bright when it was created. There is another mosaic, like I say, that shows the change in usage of the palace. So, like I say, when it's first built, sorry, I went off tangent. It's built for a purpose, and then over time, it's a bit more difficult to we don't know. It depends how it fell out of favor, who was living there, but the room seemed to have been divided. So there is, I haven't got a picture of it, but there is a mosaic where that it doesn't sort of fit into either of the rooms. And that's because the wall in the middle was built through. The room was split into two. It's absolutely massive. It's well worth a visit. And there is mosaic. I could have just shown you pictures of mosaics all afternoon, to be fair. There's a lot. Black and white ones, coloured ones, absolutely, absolutely beautiful. Let's move on to the last place, which is a bit more obvious, I admit, and it's the Roman baths at Bath. This is where there is a natural hot water spring. So there are many springs where you do see temples. You know, water, of course, is sacred. It's important. It's, you know, it's revered, however you want to describe it. But at Bath, there was a hot water spring. When the Romans come, like I say, they integrate to some extent. And they are a polytheistic culture, which was a good thing in terms of that kind of merging with the people who are already here. And Bath is a great example of that. So there was a temple. This bathing complex was built where there was a temple to the goddess Sulis Minerva. It was already, when the Romans came, there was already a Celtic settlement, and these waters were seen as sacred, healing waters, and the Celtic goddess Sulis was worshipped. You don't see the name Sulis elsewhere, so that's why it's assumed that this is a local goddess. So then the Romans come and they consciously incorporate their goddesses into, the goddess Sulis into their plans for a temple. And so they mix Sulis and Minerva, who's their the goddess of wisdom. So this temple here is built to this duo goddess Sulis Minerva. I think that is such a great example of how the Romans did that. That obviously changes once Christianity comes in and being monotheistic, but whilst they're polytheistic and the cultures that they are integrating with also are, it's a good strategy. And this is a great example of it. So the hot water spring, by the way, still exists. It still bubbles up. If you visit there today, you can see it bubbling up. The water is green. It is full of sulfur. You're not allowed to swim in it anymore, unfortunately. You can, though, still take the waters. This was very popular in Georgian and Victorian times, and perhaps I think even earlier, actually. This idea that if you drank the water, it was healing. That continued. There's 43 different minerals in this water here. It smells. It smells like something that's good for you, actually, because it's not great. It is a hold your nose and go for it anyway experience. But maybe it was 43 minerals. There's something in that was good for them. But when you go, you can still, there is one pool and you can still see this water bubbling up. In the photo that you can see on the screen now, you can see the steam coming off. So it just shows how that it is warm. It is warm water. We are nearly at an hour. That is my five places that I would, there are more. Do you know what? There are more, but there's just five places that I would recommend going to have a look at Roman Britain. Hopefully some of them you didn't know about. I will do a program on Hadrian's Wall if you wish. I would quite enjoy that. I might go up and have I might use it as an excuse to go up and have another visit, actually. But before I go, tonight, History After Dark is all about Florence Nightingale. So if you want more live shows, if I haven't bored you to death already today, then History After Dark tonight, 8:15 UK time. And I realise with the clocks changing that in other parts of the world, that might be a slightly different time difference. That will be a different time difference to what it has been in the last few weeks until our clocks change at the end of March. So anyway, 8:15 UK time, History After Dark. Tonight we're talking about Florence Nightingale in our History Heroes series. If you want to join me again next week, same time, 3 o'clock for History Tea Time Chat Live. I haven't decided what I'm going to do it on yet. Feel free to make suggestions. More Roman, says Melissa. I am enjoying my Roman history. I'm enjoying Roman, Anglo-Saxon. I don't think there is an era, actually, that Stuarts, obviously, because we're coming up to the Stuarts Online History Festival. There is an era that doesn't get me. So thank you ever so much, everybody. Have a great rest of your day. Hopefully I'll see some of you this evening. If not, I will see you next week. All right. Take care, everybody. Have a great day. Bye.